The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. All over the world, people are listening. And I take that very seriously, that people are listening in because they want information and insights that can help them make better choices to live a longer, healthier, and happier life, not only personally, but also the collective we. We as a society, we as a common good should be able to enjoy our lives. To do that, we have to challenge some pre-existing notions, and that's what we do on this program. Each day, after health and nutrition and healing, environmental updates, all of which come from the original sciences, I share insights on the common condition, on human nature. It's called issues, and I ask you to call in and share your points of view. Today, for example, my guest in the second part of our program is a scholar, visionary scholar, about civilization. He is graduate of Yale with background in philosophy and mathematics, and he's the author of Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society. I'm hopeful to have a thought-provoking conversation with him about the roots of how our materialistic notions of money and possessions as value fragment our greater spiritual purpose and have led to the crisis and corruption that exists today. So that will be our philosophical aspect. Time permitting, I will also share a commentary from Global Research from Stephen Jones on the spreading of false ideologies into our culture. I will also share the latest on environmental updates, including what's happening with the ozone layer. And France, the good news there is they become the first country to ban fracking, and that's good. And also, who's the worst polluter in the world? Do you know? Well, I'm going to tell you and how bad it is and how nothing is being done to clean up the mess they make, nor can anyone force them to. Also, two brief, and I mean very brief, insights. One is from, do you remember Mr. Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security agent? He's now saying that the middle class is at unease, and this unrest is going to be happening here. Really? Does that mean that he's going to take some responsibility for having been one of the architects of that? I'll share that with you. And then I would like to have the people in this audience who come from a variety of backgrounds, and especially those who come from inside the academic community, and we have many of those. We have professors of philosophy listening and psychology and history. I would like, if you would, to take a little test. For the next week, could you please watch the most popular programs on the left and right and current? They do some good work over there. I've watched their station, and I commend the people at Current. And Keith Urban's over there at 8 o'clock. And here's what I'd like to see if they're doing. In the last 100 days, we have seen an increase in the support for the efforts to topple Gaddafi in Libya, but giving money and arms to people who may be al-Qaeda and who have no guarantee that they're going to make the place any better than what it's been, but we're unleashing an enormous amount of depleted uranium on everyone in Libya. But why isn't anyone talking about Eastern Libyan oil, the largest oil reserve in Africa? Oh, gee, could that have anything to do with why we're supporting the Libyan rebels, but we're not supporting the people in Syria and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia or Yemen or any of the other countries where they're being slaughtered. For those people, no. No NATO, no intervention, no anything. And then what about the F-16 squadrons that were deployed by our government to Poland and the establishment of military bases in Romania and the resuscitation of the George Bush-era plans for deployment of U.S. missile defense system in Central Europe and the revival of the cordial among the new Europeans threatening humanitarian intervention in Syria and renewed talk of military action against Iran and a push for a long-term military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and revving up the expansion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Wasn't that supposed to have been disbanded when the Cold War ended? And also NATO now into Central Asia, and violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Pakistan, and the threat of regime change in Sri Lanka. You didn't know about that? And recently, the deployment of light combat ships in Singapore. Didn't know about that? Now, mind you, all of this has happened in the last 100 days. And also, what about the Caspian Sea and the great game that's going on there? The effort to try to position ourselves to make sure that we can control where the gas and the oil goes, but then we're not able to do that anymore. Real issues. Why is that an issue? Let me explain this. If the American public does not understand that we have so destroyed the capacity to deal intelligently and in a proper way with the Eurasian countries, then you understand what's really at stake. We went into Afghanistan, a Eurasian country, that was crucial to the transport of natural gas. So right now, the Kremlin views energy as a tool to pursue an assertive foreign policy. And Europe's level of dependence on Russia for energy is very high. And Russia's attempts to exclude the U.S. from Central Asia, the Caspian energy markets. All this is going on. And we know nothing about it. Americans are virtually illiterate on this topic. But guess who's now in a new partnership? China and Russia. And all of those former satellite republics of Russia, now they want to have gas go from one point that has an unlimited amount to everywhere in that area of the world under China and Russian control. Where's that lead of America? It leaves them out. So I'll get with this on tomorrow's program in depth, because I believe it's also important that we start to expand our awareness beyond the reality talk shows and who won Dancing with the Stars, and looking at the world, and then you'll understand why we're setting up these military posts in these countries, why we're bribing the officials, why we're creating an interdiction that is counterproductive to the needs of Americans, why we're going bankrupt. All the while, we're ready to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which we shouldn't be doing, so that we can pay for this. So I believe that we should look at the world as it is and take an honest and objective understanding of what we should be doing. Now, I've been against fluoride since I read the original Science. I wrote a definitive article on it, which you can read. It's up on the website, and it's called The Fluoride Fiasco. Here's the latest reason why fluoride should not be used ever in any product. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Neuralgia. New study, fluoride can damage the brain. Avoid use in children. I'll quote this. The research team reports, quote, it's important to be aware of this serious problem and avoid the use of toothpaste and items that contain fluoride, particularly in children, as they are more susceptible to the toxic effects of fluoride. Fluoride can be toxic by ingesting one part per million. That's what you get in a glass of water. And the effects are not immediate, as they can take up to 20 years or more to become evident, unquote. Now, most fluoridated water in U.S. Public drinking systems, people are unaware. They're delivering one part per million of fluoride, and equals about 1 milligram per quart. and that's supposed to protect our teeth, and it doesn't. Quote, fluoridation clearly jeopardizes our children, must be stopped. That's according to attorney Paul Bieber, president of the New York State group opposed to fluoridation. Quote, we can actually see how fluoride has damaged children's teeth with dental fluorosis, but we can't see the harm it's doing to their brains and other organs. No U.S. researchers even looking. But when they did look, they found that fluoride crosses the blood-brain barrier and can cause biochemical and fundamental changes in the nervous system during pregnancy. And since fluoride accumulates in the brain tissue before birth, they're very concerned. In animal studies, show fluoride's toxic brain effects include classic brain abnormalities found in patients with Alzheimer's, and that's why they're opposed to it. So that's just the latest study of why we shouldn't be consuming fluoride. I received an email from a physician, and he said that he began listening when two of his patients said that they no longer had the problems that they originally went to the doctor with, not because of any medicines the doctor gave, but because they were following the program. They are listening on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. So he wrote and said, if he were to help people with type 2 diabetes, what would be some foods that he would give? He would feel more comfortable giving foods than nutrients. And I said, just look at the scientific literature. There's a University of Rhode Island researcher named Serum who said nature's the best chemist. Boy, he was correct. We have to look at what's in the different foods and first whether or not they will impact in a positive or negative way the glycemic index or whether the person's blood sugar goes up or down. What we want is the sugar to go down. Now, long ago in Ayurvedic medicine, healers were using natural herbs and spices to treat a variety of conditions, including diabetes. Two spices that are consumed in Indian food offer some protection against diabetes. So for the doctor and for anyone else who cares about diabetes, write these down, please. It's the yellow-orange powder turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C. It's made from the rhizomes of a plant native to South Asia. Very common there. My suggestion, but if you're going to eat it in food, take a lot of it, and there's no downside. And if you're going to use it as capsules, where you get a more punch, about 5,000 to 6,000 milligrams. Now, research in the past decade alone has shown that turmeric not only aids against diabetes, but also helps cleanse the liver. It's a really terrific anti-inflammatory. It can protect against breast and prostate cancers. It can help against depression and slows the advance of Alzheimer's disease. Now, there's a chemical in turmeric called curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, curcumin. And it's the number one ingredient in turmeric, and it has a lot of healing. Now, there are other substances you could use as well, including spices like fenugreek, fen, F-E-N-U-G-R-E-E-K, fenugreek, and it can protect you against diabetes. It has the added benefit of boosting the male sex drive, enhancing liver function, and lowering your cholesterol. There was recently a study of the Waipik people of Alaska, and that showed that consuming a type of fish rich in omega-3 fatty acids can protect against diabetes. Now, that study is particularly interesting because it suggests the link between obesity and diabetes may be more complex than originally thought. And although 70% of the population in that tribe is classified as obese, only 3% have diabetes. Fish, which contains the omega-3 fatty acids, include mackerel, wild salmon, lake trout, herring, tuna. Those are your best. And they therefore give high amounts of the omega-3 fatty acids, which can help with diabetes. Now, here's something that's surprising. Normally, if you have diabetes, you don't want to be taking in sugars. But dark chocolate is known, based upon an Italian study I found, to reduce insulin resistance. Now, do not go out and buy the commercial high-sugar dairy preservative-loaded chocolate. No, I'm talking about raw, unprocessed coca, C-O-C-O-A, coca, without any refined sugars added. And then if you want to sweeten it with a little bit of date palm sugar, that's fine. It has very low glycemic. Some xylitol, stevia, that's fine too. So you don't have to sacrifice sweet taste if you have diabetes. Also, the darker the chocolate, with minimal processing, the healthier it is for you. And you can make a lot of different dishes with it. And cocoa powder and baking chocolate contain the highest levels of the flavonoids responsible for the positive health effects we know about chocolate. But most people do not buy or use baking chocolate. In point of fact, it's your best. Yes, it doesn't have any sweetness to it at all, but you can add that. And also, if you are taking the phytochemicals from coffee beans, not coffee beans that have not been processed. And in fact, when you take the beans, it increases the plasma levels of sex hormone binding globulin, which regulates the biological activity of the body's sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen. And these hormones play a very important role in type 2 diabetes. Also, there are products on the market called grape seed extract. And you can get that, or you can eat some red grapes seed with seeds in it. They're rich in polyphenols, and they regulate glucose levels. And that can help prevent some potential dangerous plunges and surges in your blood sugar level. And also, blueberries are very good to reduce the risk of diabetes. And they also help you lose fat, and they're great as a natural laxative. There was a recent research report from the University of Michigan's Cardiovascular Center found that blueberries in the diet significantly improved health of the laboratory rats. Researchers also believe that the higher levels of phytochemicals, those include the pigments. So berries are dark blue, that's good. Cherries are good. Strawberries, cranberries, all have phytochemicals. All are good if you have diabetes. So I would use anything rich in the anthocyanidins, like cherries, very good. That will impact your pancreas in a positive way. And then your beans. There's over 100 different types of beans, and they regulate your blood glucose and insulin levels. They can help prevent diabetes or minimize the effects of those diagnosed with it. And it also helps lower your cholesterol. And the red bean and pinto bean are your two best, along with soybeans. Black beans are also good. And then something most people wouldn't think would help with diabetes, but it does, and that's coconut oil. Because of its very unusual molecular structure, it is superior to almost any other oil, and except for olives. Olive, safflower, and sunflower are all built from a long-chain fatty acid group. And these long chains are either deposited in blood vessels as cholesterol or stored as fat around the walls, thighs, and the buttocks. So on the other hand, the coconut oil's medium-chain fatty acids immediately become available as energy. And these are smaller, easily absorbed, medium-chain molecules supply the cells with the essential fatty acids without glucose and without inhibiting insulin production. Also, if you have yeast, if you have fungus, or any form of viral property, coconut oil is great. It's antimicrobial, antifungal, antiviral, antibacterial, and tastes good too. Then walnuts and almonds help prevent diabetes by regulating blood glucose. And it also helps stabilize blood sugar. And so then look at your grains like buckwheat, which is technically a fruit rather than a grain, but it can help control blood sugar. And it's been extolled for diabetes for years. So buckwheat is right up there at the high end of the spectrum. And then cinnamon. And there, a lot of cinnamon is good for you. It also helps clear your sinuses, helps turn off inflammation of arthritis, helps clear up urinary tract infections, helps prevent gum disease. Yes, cinnamon does all that. Plus, it's great for regulating blood sugar. And then we'll round it off with your teas. Red tea, oolong tea, black tea, white tea, and green tea. They're all good. And by the way, green tea may help prevent the progression of type 1 diabetes or prevent this disorder. And green tea regulates blood glucose. It's an important function since the pancreas in type 1 diabetics produce little or no insulin. The hormone responsible for converting glucose, which is sugar and starches and other foods, into energy. So green tea lowers blood sugar levels in type 2 diabetes and reduces consumption's cravings. So it's just great. So to the good doctor in California, those are some things that will make a difference if you get them into your patients, and also see vegetables help as well. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Program. I'm Gary Nall. Just some short updates and then commentary, your calls, and then we'll go to our guest in about 15 minutes from now. The worst polluter on the planet? The U.S. Department of Defense. That's right. According to Project Censored, the U.S. military, quote, is responsible for the most egregious and widespread pollution on the planet, yet this information and accompanying documentation goes almost entirely unreported. In spite of the evidence, the environmental impact of the U.S. military goes largely unaddressed by environmental organizations and was not the focus of any discussions or proposed restrictions at the recent UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen. This impact includes uninhibited use of fossil fuels, massive creation of greenhouse gases, and extensive release of radioactive and chemical contaminants in the air, water, and soil. The extensive global operation of the U.S. military, wars, interventions, and secret operations on over 1,000 bases around the world and 6,000 facilities in the United States are not counted against U.S. greenhouse gas limits. So, they're the worst. Not a single thing's being done. They say officially 320,000 barrels a day of oil go to the military. That's official. But then unofficially, it could be as half as a high, half a million. So, just to give you an idea, the Iraq war was responsible for at least 141 million metric tons of carbon dioxide in just a short three-year period. In fact, the war emits more than 60% of that of all countries in the world. No one told you about that, and yet not a single person is standing up and saying, you mean when you do your calculations for greenhouse gas, you're not including anything from the military, and yet they represent 60% of all this stuff? No. Good news from France. A major setback for the oil and gas industry. The French Senate voted to ban hydraulic fracking, which is known as fracking, the controversial gas industry drilling method, which is being challenged worldwide. And so that's good news. The ban on fracking is a major victory for the French public and where the health and safety and water contamination impacts that unconventional gas drilling would have on communities. But that message didn't get to the governor of New York or the legislature or in New Jersey or other states. We're just full-headed, steam ahead with gas fracking, and we will pay enormous consequences because of that. Now the issue, and here it is. This is from Paul Joseph Watson from Infowars.com. It's short. Zygmunt Brzezinski, who 40 years ago wrote a highly controlled future society book where the population would be subjugated by a technocratic elite, appeared on MSNBC Morning Joe yesterday to predict that middle-class unrest caused by economic disenfranchisement would soon hit America. Quote, I don't want to be a prophet of doom, and I don't think we are approaching doom, but I think we're going to slide into intensified social conflicts, social hostility, some forms of radicalism. There's just going to be a sense that this is not a just society. And that's what he said, adding that civil unrest would begin when the lower middle class becomes severely affected by the economic fallout and rising unemployment. By the way, he was the former national security advisor, predicted, quote, really serious international turmoil, you think, as a result of the United States, Europe, and Japan, the three traditional pillars of global economics, and they're all struggling. By the way, he is a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Brzezinski's so-called concern about disparity and fair society, as the rich get richer, the middle class becomes poor, is completely hypocritical given the fact that he wrote books four decades ago virtually advocating precisely that system of governance, where a tiny elite ruthlessly control and dominate the rest of humanity. However, this is certainly not the first time that Brzezinski has expressed concerns that a growing rage caused by economic and social disenfranchisement could threaten the existing power structure. During a Council on Foreign Relations speech in Montreal last year, Brzezinski, who's a regular attendee of the elitist Bilderberg Group meeting, warned of a, quote, global political awakening. You think? The whole world is waking up? Iceland, based upon good advice given to them quietly behind the scenes by Professor Michael Hudson. Maybe I shouldn't be telling that, but he is one of the leading economists around the world that countries bring in when they don't know what to do. They said no to the European Union, to the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And now you've got Greece that's going off the cliff. I predict that within the next 6 months, the citizens of Greece will simply put so much pressure upon their government through general strikes that they will have to modify this whole idea that we're going to take every nickel we have in the country and give it to the banks, and you all have to give us back money and take back hours of work and suffer. That's not going to happen. Maybe when you get so powerful that your feet never hit the actual pavement, you live in that stratified area of life where everything's ethereal. You have so much money and so many yes people around you, and all your connections are inbred, where the rich only associate with the rich, the powerful only with the powerful, that you just never know what it's like to be an average person because you haven't been and you're not. So you don't know what it's like when a mother wakes up in the morning and she has four kids and she doesn't have enough money to buy food for them throughout the day, and they hope that a school teacher will have enough of a kind heart to see that kid's not studying and is hungry and can't focus and their blood sugar's down and buys them something, gives them an apple, gives them something. No, the Bill Gates, they don't have to worry about kids going to class hungry, couch hopping, hoping you don't get thrown out before an uncle or an aunt finally say that we can't take it anymore, our house is already too small, you're going to have to move out. They haven't been thrown out of houses. And how many people are couch surfing right now? Let me just give you an idea. Almost as many people live in the entire state of California. Almost 35 million Americans are homeless in the sense that they've lost their original home, and now they're couch surfing. And because they're not all on the street, we think, oh, there's not a problem. Drive down some of the streets in middle-class America and count how many cars are in a driveway, and you see a small 1,200, 1,400-square-foot house. You think that they're there to watch a ball game? No, they're living there. So the people who are very powerful, who control the world, could you imagine if they ever stop and wonder what the suffering is like of another? Not for a millisecond. That's our issue. So do you think the middle class in America, not the middle class is never going to do anything in America. Forget that. The upper middle class, the educated class, they're not going to do anything. The professional class, the professors, the educators, the lawyers, accountants, CPAs, forget them. Engineers, architects, forget them. The senior citizens, dead. Forget them altogether, 1,000%. Bet your life you'll never see it. Them go to the streets. The upper middle class in communities, forget it. They don't stick their head out of their gated communities, whether it's in Scottsdale, Arizona, or Naples, Florida, unless someone says it's time to golf again, the rain's gone. The rich, you can't even get them to laugh when you say, will you protest anything? Will you risk anything? No. The poor, forget the poor. The poor are not going to be ahead of any march. Then who? How about someone you forgot about? Someone no one talks with. How about 60 million working poor? That's who. Oh, we didn't even... That's not the Lou Dobbs. No, Lou missed it completely. That's not the... No, you missed it. That's who's out there about to explode. You think they will? What do you think we're going to do in America? You think we're going to have the same awareness that they had 100 million young people going to the streets in 22 Arab League nations to demand freedoms and jobs and equality and the end of corruption and state-sanctioned corruption and the influence of America in maintaining a geopolitical stranglehold and supporting dictators and tyrants and death and destruction? You think that now that it's going through there and it's happening in Malaysia, it's happening in all over the world, it's happening in Europe, you think that we will be the only place in the world that won't get it? Maybe, maybe not. Oh, I'm interested in your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Will America be the only country in the world that will forget to come to the party? Which party? How about the party that kicks the people who are in power out of power and establishes, if nothing else, that they're just sick and tired and not going to take it anymore? Back in a moment. Hear what your thoughts are. Please stay with us. Say hello to Mike from New Jersey. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? How are you doing?
Good.
I just want to say you have a great show, very informative. And I like to, we mentioned before about the military polluting the planet. Can you talk about, like, I know also with their weapons, they use radioactive weapons, too, which pollute the planet also. Do you have any information on that, too?
Yeah, we're going to be doing a whole program
on
HAARP.
Okay.
Yes, a whole program. Yeah. We just did a program on chemtrails. And we have another program coming this Friday where we're having the woman scientist back who looked at 20,000 photographs, and this is what her specialty in science as a professor, Clemson University, is, in the special area of thermal engineering, how the towers and steel in the towers disintegrated, not from heat, not from impact. So that is a form of weaponization. All that's going to be talked about in a new one-hour program this Friday. You won't want to miss that, all right?
Okay, sure. Thank you very much.
All right, good. Chris from Queens, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. I just wanted to say that, tying into what you were saying earlier, regarding the economic situation, and more specifically in Greece, just for the people who kind of have forgotten, and I realize Americans have so much on their mind, but as far as the IMF is concerned, and the only people who have actually referred to this is Michael Hudson on your program and on other interviews, and I forgot the other one, Mark Weisbrot, specifically that the way the issue is presented here, it is that Greece is separate, the United States is in a separate situation. If people just stop to think for a minute, the IMF is comprised of the G7 countries, if I'm not mistaken, and they have their executive board, and on that board sits the great U.S. Treasury, which makes major decisions. So all of the things that are going on are directly tied to the U.S. Treasury, you know, and these decisions that are being made, supposedly that they're kind of on the sidelines watching, it's not so. I happen to speak Greek fluently. I watch the Greek news. I have a relative living there. So, I've been following the situation, trying to understand it as much as I possibly can. And basically what has happened is that Greece was a weak link in this whole euro. And they found it as a scapegoat, basically. They're the poster child, sort of to shake their finger at all of the other European countries because they're making major changes there. It's not going to happen in Italy. I think they're trying to stir up a little bit of fear. Italy is a different country. It has a much larger economy. But nevertheless, Greece was found in a place that they were weaker because they're a smaller country. Their economy was not the German economy. And it's really unfortunate that they've been put in a situation where they're basically between a rock and a hard place. And speaking about Greece, if anybody knows Greek mythology, it's between Scylla and Charybdis. The Ulysses, when he was stuck, had to choose between which death. That's what they've done to the country.
But I believe that they do have a positive solution. Look, for a long time, the generals were utterly corrupt and made sure that no major corporations or no major wealthy individuals paid any income tax at all. Then they also bought votes. They put a lot of people to work at no work jobs in order to guarantee that they got reelected. The patronage system was deep and embedded in their society. And unfortunately, many of the top union people also went along with this because everybody benefited, because the presumption was that the money will be there. Then in came the military and the military advisors from the United States and says, you all should have some submarines. You all should have built up your armaments. And they did. Billions of dollars spent that they didn't need and shouldn't have spent. Then Goldman Sachs came in and showed, look, we don't want the world to see that you're as bankrupt as you are, so we're going to fix your books. We're going to do an Enron-style magical accounting. You're going to look healthier than you are. They paid Goldman Sachs $400 million for that. That became unraveled. That's when it all came down. Now they're asking for the Greek people to be saddled with between $450 and $500 billion, or about 180% debt to the gross domestic product. That means that for every dollar that they raise from any source, they have to spend $1.80 on repaying the debt. Now, who are they repaying it to? To the banks. Who caused the problems? The banks. So who's made to suffer? The public. They could go through a structured bankruptcy, go back to the original currency, and reclaim the right to be self-sufficient, get rid of all of the international funds, get rid of all these arms, downsize the corrupt part of their government, but not cut social spending on where it's necessary, on education and health care, and in effect then put in place proper income tax rules that the rich as well as everyone else has to pay, and corporations also have to pay. If they did that, they could do what Argentina did and what I'm hopeful that Ireland will do and what Iceland is currently doing. And if all goes well, Lithuania will be following. So there is a way out.
Iceland had their own currency, though, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They didn't get into your opinion.
Okay, well, that's a huge consideration here, because that's another discussion about, that's what I'm saying, when they were really tied in, because when they made that transition from the drachma to the euro, it was much more expensive as compared to the German mark, for example. And I mean, we don't realize that because, if you're not in finance, you don't really think about that. That was a huge consideration. What I'm saying is that Greece had its own problems and its own corruption, as every country does. What I'm saying is that the way this was done, it was basically the European elite who did it for their own interests. And by the way, with this whole situation in the last 2.5 years, when the country's been literally attacked, I mean, if they had bombed the country, to use a figure of speech, Germany's been doing very well on this because of their own exports, because they export so much, and they're making a lot of money off of it. What I'm saying is that Greece is being attacked by all ends, and people have their interests.
I agree with you, but Greece has got to get out of the European Union. They've got to get back their own currency, and they've got to say no and go through a bankruptcy. But right now, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and all these corporations have taken derivative positions into the hundreds of billions of dollars. That's why the negative press is that don't let Greece slip off the cliff, protect them, make them pay, go through austerity, because Wall Street doesn't want to end up losing hundreds of billions of dollars.
That's
they
right.
don't care a damn about Greece. We've got to run. Thank you very much. We're going to go to our guest in a moment, who's standing by. But let's say hello to one more person on the line here. And I can't get to any more today, but I will on other shows, and I thank you for calling in. Let's say hello to John from New Jersey. Hi, John.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for all the great work that you do. Just my thoughts about Americans rising up against economical situation. I feel as Americans, I guess, as we get poorer, and like you mentioned before, as people just get more affected by the economy, they will rise up, and because basically, they won't be able to afford the distractions, the iPod, the TV shows. You know, they may lose all that. Maybe people have lost that already, and then they'll be able to focus on what's wrong with their life and what we got here. And hopefully then, without the distractions in people's lives, that they'll just be more focused on how to make life better and how to vote, get the voting, and just taking care of people's families.
Okay, well, I think that's very valid. That's a very valid statement. Thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing that with us. It's getting there. I believe it'll happen within the next 2 years. If any of you did not have a chance last evening to hear Gerald Celante on what was a two-hour special I did on our banking system, from the Rothschilds and all the Mellons and the J.P. Morgans, and how it all started, where it went, how it got up to this time, the betrayal of Alexander Hamilton, George Washington copping out, a really bad point that was made about George Washington and how he got... how he ended up signing the Constitutionalists, the Federalist Papers, all that I discussed last night. Plus, I did a almost 45-minute interview with Gerald Celante on what's happening in the United States. Gerald is the opinion we will not have any uprising in the United States, popular protest. He believes it's over. He believes we're going to go through now a systematic fascist takeover. Fascism's when corporate interest and governmental interest become one and the same. And he believes we're in it now. He believes it's only going to get worse. And he believes that by the time people wake up, it'll be too late. When it starts happening to individuals, then there won't be anyone to protect you. That's his point of view. I will share my point of view tomorrow on what's going to be happening, what I see happening in the United States, and what has happened to the left and the right that they've contributed to this. Anyhow, more on that tomorrow. I don't want to keep anything any more less time for my guest today. And also, if you did not listen to that program, but by the way, 41,000 people did, give you an idea, that would have ranked it right up in the top listened to radio programs in the United States last night, and that was just over the Internet. You can go to progressiveradionetwork.com, that's progressiveradionetwork.com, and it's on the archives. It's a two-hour special on our economy, and on finance, and on politics and corruption, and on the history of finance and banking and the Federal Reserve. It's all there. A series of commentaries by myself and others and Gerald Salante, and you can download the programs. They're there to listen to. Let's say hello now to my guest, Charles Eisenstein. He is a visionary scholar. He focuses upon the nature of civilizations and the economics and transpersonal psychology all interwoven into actualizing. What do you do with your life? Do you become materialistic? Do you become selfish? Do you become philanthropic? Do you care about how you make your money? Do you look at the consequences or not? He's here to share his insights. He's the author of Sacred Economics. He's a graduate of Yale. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
Charles, I'd like to first hear your views on how money has become this almost transcendent abstraction with qualities that has become the focus of not only this culture, but now global culture at large. And when we really look at the power wielded by the oligarchical elite based upon the value only on paper, numbers and computers with no substantial value or worth in reality, it appears that money, from the vantage point of the sacred, is really a kind of illusion. And power based upon wealth is an illusion. The influence of corporations, politicians, and banks and financial firms is likewise kind of an illusion based upon this non-reality. And yet this illusion now dominates the majority of human interactions. Is it what determines whether we live in a palace or a gutter, or our entire culture revolves around it and determines the policies that most affect our lives and sustainability and our well-being? So please share the big picture with us, and then the evolution of money in the context of becoming profane, but with almost divine qualities, albeit in a distorted manner. The forum is yours.
Yeah, it's just amazing how powerful money is when, on a physical level, it's nothing but slips of paper or really just bits in computers. It almost doesn't exist on a physical level. And yes, I buy something in the store, sometimes I marvel at the fact that I can get all this food, and all I have to do is run a card through a reader and some numbers change in a computer, and I get all this stuff. It's kind of miraculous. And, of course, the reason that these symbols have power is because we agree that they have power. Their power comes from our agreements that assign value to them. And So I call it a story of value, and that story, that system of interpretations, is tied into deeper stories that hold our society together. So that's why it's powerful, because beyond the level of your own hands, anything that human beings create in this world happens through the coordination of human activity, through communication, through symbols. And money is foremost among them. And, you know, I wrote this book starting by wondering, why is this common story driving us toward ruin, when really money should be a way to facilitate the flow of gifts? What has turned it into the force that is destroying the world? Anytime you investigate any disturbing phenomenon and you ask, why is this happening? A couple levels down, a couple levels of why, you always get to money. And on a personal level, too, it's the beautiful things that we want to do, the noble impulses, they're the things that get blocked by, oh, but can I afford to do that? And the things that we don't really want to do, often that's where the money is. And so why is money, when it's really just a system of agreements, why is it driving us to destroy ourselves? And because it's a system of agreements, what new story of money, what new system of money could encourage the opposite? So that's kind of where I've started my investigation and drawn together various threads of thought going back centuries or sometimes millennia.
Um, Well, yeah. Let's take it a little further then, and that is, from a psychological and a spiritual perspective, what is it about this kind of mystery that money holds on us, and what do you see the negative results have been for our money-based civilization? And also, I'd like to hear your views about our present economic paradigm as one founded on the idea of never-ending growth and accumulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so money is, you know, I mentioned these deeper stories that money is a part of. And one of, there's two, really, that define our civilization. And one of them is kind of this personal psychological story, the story of self, that says, you know, what is it to exist? What is it to be human? What are you? And it kind of goes back to Descartes. You know, it says you're basically this discrete, separate subject, this bubble of psychology in an external, in a world that's external to you, that's objective. There's other bubbles of psychology, other skin-encapsulated souls, you know, out there in this separate world. And therefore, more for me is less for you, because there's a finite world out there. And security comes through control. And we're essentially in competition with each other. And that's what economics says at the very base level. It says human beings seek to maximize self-interest. Biology even says that beings seek to maximize reproductive self-interest. And so it's kind of this, as Steiner would put it, a war of all against all. And our money system very much reflects that. It, because it's based on interest-bearing debt, there's never enough money. The amount of money in existence is always less than the amount of debt. And so our money system encourages competition, gives us a perception of scarcity. And then the other story, the civilizational story, that money is also a part of, and this is the effect of it, if it's that it compels endless growth. I call it the story of the people, or ascent, that humanity was once just like an animal, ignorant and helpless, but then we developed science and technology and came to harness natural forces, to transcend natural limitations, to grow the human realm, to make the world ours, to domesticate the wild. And someday, according to this myth, our ascent will be complete. We will become, as Descartes said, the lords and masters of nature. And all the world will be turned into property and will be under our control. And money, again, because of its character as interest-bearing debt, compels this growth, forces it. And when the growth stops happening, then the money system quickly goes into crisis. And that's what we're seeing today. When growth stops, then wealth polarizes very quickly, and you get deflationary depression or hyperinflation, or there's many different ways that the money system can break down. But basically, it doesn't work. It works okay if the economy is growing and if there's more and more of the world to convert into money, into goods and services, into commodities. But what we're seeing today is a slowdown of growth, first happening in the industrialized countries, and then, you know, we go to third world countries and convert their natural capital and social capital into money as well, and kind of import growth through colonialism from other countries. And at some point, though, that reaches a limit too. And now we can't convert much more of the planet into money. We can't increase the harvest of fish because the fisheries are depleted. We can't cut down more forests or drill more oil or convert more relationships into services either. That's been a major source of growth. You know, find something that people do for each other in a gift economy, turn it into services, somehow make it illegal or inconvenient to exchange in a gift economy, and then sell that back to them as a service. People pay for almost everything today, and so there's not that much room left for growth, and we try to kind of eke out a little bit more growth. You know, maybe we could drill the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge, you know, or there's still some beauty that can be converted into money, but not much, no matter how hard we try.
Charles, that's like saying, let no money be left on the table. Take it all off. My guess, Charles Eisenstein, and he is the author of Sacred Economics, to some of the stations around the United States who are going to have to sign off, we thank you. And for those of you who want to continue to listen to the rest of this conversation, please go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Charles, I just have two more questions for you, but I think that they're central to almost everyone. When I look at how we have used the formula you just spoke about, I see that we've taken people who have needs. They need food. They need shelter. And we have already devastated, or nature has devastated, or a combination of the two, their natural living environment. And now they're moving into cities. And just take Bangladesh as an example. There's now 1.6 million women every day going to work in slave labor factories, making 920 million garments a year that are shipped just to the United States, where different brand names are put on. They're paid 14 cents an hour. Yep. And so that money to them, $5.50 a week, and they have to work about 18-hour days, and they're only allowed two breaks, and men walk up and down the aisles with switches and will smack them, and they're not allowed to talk. There's no socializing. These women still have families. By the time they get home, their families are asleep. In the middle of the night, these families are making the meal for their families or doing the laundry. So they don't even have a chance to go home and go to sleep. And some, by the way, are so tired at the end of their shift, they simply sleep at their station and then get up, go to the bathroom, go right back to work. And that they do until the age of 30. Then their life expectancy in the workplace is over. They're frequently crippled. They frequently have carpal tunnel syndrome or diseases in the lungs because there's no ventilation from all the cloth and the dust and the pesticide used in it. And yet, in the United States, major corporations will pride themselves, as well their stockholders, that we all did well. See, you got a nice reward on your stock, and we gave you a good payment on it, so keep believing in us. We're going to give money to our boards. And no one stops and says, what was the human capital involved? How was it impacted? Because if we had on a screen for every item that you buy, from the pair of shoes that's made over in Madrid, one of the large capitals, or Portugal, the shoe capital of the world, and show how they're having to work at slave labor, or a dress being made in Bangladesh or in a Singapore sweatshop, if we saw half the screen the reality of how it took, what it took to get that to our plates, and then the other half just showing the finished product and how all the energy, all the money is on creating an illusion of greatness, of sustainability, and the fact we don't have those forests anymore. The Chinese bought the largest forest in Peru, the large mahogany forest. They're gone now. All over the world, we're buying everything. We're non-sustainable, yet no one wants to acknowledge this. No country wants to acknowledge it. No one in the American legislature wants to acknowledge it. No one in the American media wants to acknowledge it. And the grand priests of the new Inquisition, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and these others, they say just the opposite. We're a great country. We're the greatest country. We're going to keep being great. We've got to keep growing. And I'm saying, my God, you can't be that insane. We don't have the resources. You've exploited the resources through neocolonialism everywhere. Stop for a moment. And for everyone else that are just living like gluttons, especially Americans, selfish gluttons, do you care at all about anything except your next turn of the TV channel, your next Twitter, or your next mouthful of French fries? Your final thoughts, please.
Yeah, there's just level upon level upon level of insanity. You know, those 920 million garments produced by essentially slave labor in Bangladesh. I mean, the irony is that they don't even really serve a real need of Americans. You know, we don't even need that many clothes. And this has been a problem. You know, this is the problem of overproduction. Not only do you have to produce more and more and more, but you also have to increase demand. And one way to increase demand is to make people miserable, to cut them off from their connections to community and to nature. And then the the lonely, alienated self that's left seeks to expand somehow to reclaim some of these lost connections through consumerism, perhaps. Or in America, if you're poor and you really can't consume too much through purchases, then maybe you consume a lot of food and become obese. And I think that, you know, I mean, it can look like, you know, we Americans are just greedy and selfish and there's something wrong with us. But that behavior is really built into the system. Money makes people greedy. I've been reading studies about how poor people are much more generous than rich people. They devote more of their income to charity. They share more. And money, but when they have, the more money they have, the more invested in it they are, and the less generous they are. We've had this, but you know, I think you're right in just calling us on the insanity of the ideology of growth. It's not just the conservatives. I mean, the liberals too. Everybody says, you know, the purpose of economic policy is to reignite economic growth.
I just want to interrupt and then I'll allow you to finish your thoughts, please. Recently, I was at a rally. I go to a lot of rallies. I believe in being there physically in body as well as if I'm invited to get up and speak at these different demonstrations. And there were people who were rightly concerned about the power of the banking system and how its usurious lending rates that if a mob figure were brought to trial, they would be charging less than Bank of America on a debit card that's late, and which can go to 2,000% interest. Insane as it may seem, and I actually gave an example of how a college guy out in California bought on his debit card a pizza for $14, but he didn't have the money in the debit card, so it ended up costing him $247 in fees and penalties. And yet that's considered completely acceptable, normal, and actually good business by those who believe in the trickle-down theory. Now, here is my point. At that rally where they were willing to go across street and lock arms around the Bank of America outlet there, and we had a good presentation, Chris Hedges, myself, and others got up and spoke, then you start seeing people who were smoking cigarettes, wearing designer jeans, and eating McDonald's and drinking Coca-Cola. So I asked one of the people, I said, which part of globalization are you really against? Oh, man, I'm against it. I said, but you're drinking a cola, you're eating McDonald's, you're wearing a Tommy Hilfiger shirt, you got on the Nike sneakers, and so how does that align with this? Are you taking one piece of a larger puzzle and making that the justification that you're doing your thing? And I believe on the left in particular, there's a great deal of confusion about people who are against fascism, but we haven't done a thing to go out there and march against the fascist laws that are now in effect, or the evisceration of our habeas corpus and Fourth Amendment and other issues. And then they'll turn right around and go think about this by going over to McDonald's and sitting there and thinking about what our next move would be. I can't get them to see. They don't want to go organic. They don't want to go back to nature. That's too hippish. That's too denialist. No, it's not. You know, and getting them to stop going to Starbucks and start going to a local farmer's market. Well, that's too corny. That's not intellectual enough. No, it is. There's a great deal of consciousness when you go to a farmer's market and you buy something locally grown that's organic, and you don't buy anything you don't need, and you take your money out of a Citibank and a Bank of America, and you stop trading in those commodities that are essential to life. And I can't get that message through most of the liberal and democratic minds because their leaders, Bill Clinton, Al Gore, look at them. You know, they're not models of anything that I consider progressive or healthy. And you have the same thing on the right you have on the left. But the left prides itself in being more elitist, you know, smarter. And they're not. They're not living. They're in this kind of delusional denial about the relationship of things that are not sustainable. And what's not sustainable right now in the United States is truth. Your final thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, I'm always careful about judging people too harshly for the ways in which they are not living in alignment with the beliefs that they profess.
I have no problem with that, Charles.
You know, like here I am, you know, speaking about these things and speaking about economics and how to realign economy and ecology and all that kind of stuff. And I'm flying around doing that. My ecological footprint is probably quite large because of the air travel that I do and the driving. And someone could easily criticize me on those grounds. Charles, you know, don't you get it? Your lifestyle is inconsistent with the ideals that you espouse. And, you know, yeah, I mean, everyone always has a good reason, a good story that justifies the way that they live.
But we're not asking for perfection. We're just asking to pull back. I would not judge you, and I don't believe it would be fair to judge you if you were taking your message that could inspire and awaken people to the real problems. If you took a plane someplace, if you took a private jet, that's a different story. If you drove a car, look, I just finished driving to 37 states over about 41 days. I could have flown there. I chose not to. The smallest car, the most energy efficient car, but I still had to do that to make the film on Poverty, Inc., going into people's homes no one would have ever seen, seeing what's in a refrigerator of a poor person in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that no one would ever look in someone's refrigerator. No one's going to go and look in a refrigerator. I want to see what are you all eating in this family, and seeing that some of them are eating cat food. So that's not the issue. The issue is, are you looking at trying to change your own life as best you can to align with a higher spiritual ideal, where money is not your God, but rather using what money you do have and what resources are available to you in a more conscious way? That's all I'm suggesting.
You know, I'll tell you, I almost never see anybody seriously change their life until it falls apart, until the way that they had been living just isn't working anymore. And I think societies are the same way. But when things do fall apart, then changes that seemed impossibly radical all of a sudden become common sense. And I think that what's happening today is that the world and the life that had been handed to us and as normal, offered to us as normal, isn't working anymore. It's falling apart. The world is falling apart. People often get that sense when they lose their job or something like that. It seems like the world's falling apart, and then they're ready to entertain new ways of thinking and new ways of being. And today, it's starting to happen on a collective level. It almost happened in 2008. The system almost completely disintegrated, but they patched it up together temporarily. But now even the elites are on some level aware that the fix is a temporary fix and that they've only postponed the inevitable. When that happens, then all of the proposals from people mostly on the left for how to live sustainably, how to obey the principles of ecology in economics, you know, how to, I mean, all this stuff we sense it's related, you know, to preserve indigenous cultures, you know, to preserve the rainforests, to, I mean, all of the proposals and methods and technologies to do all these things are out there. But these will become common sense when the ideology of growth and separation just becomes untenable. And that's the, and I don't think transformation can happen any other way, which is why the breakdown of the financial system interests me. So I think it's we're really on the verge of some pretty interesting times. And we might go through a period of fascism, like you were saying before.
I definitely believe that we're going to go through fascism. I believe that we are now in the early stages of that, and I think that we didn't pay attention to the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the fact that we have a lot of self-serving people who are former military personnel at the highest levels, generals and lieutenant generals and brigadier generals and admirals, who then align themselves with military contractors. One audit recently showed that there are 10 separate corporations receiving hundreds of millions of dollars to do the same identical work, but no one wanted to say no to all of them. They're all feeding at that public trough. and they're not going to go away. Once you start one of these organizations, and they're going to stay. And so if you're out there doing spying, you're going to keep spying. In fact, just to give you an idea, see, this is what concerns me that we're not talking about in the media. For example, this is the latest. This just came out this morning. And it says, quote, government wiretaps increased by 34% last year. And this is from the Daily Caller, quote, the number of wiretaps conducted by federal and state law enforcement last year jumped 34% than the prior year. And yet, when they examined all these wiretaps, they found that that the vast majority had nothing to do with anything that caused a person to be arrested. But they were wiretapping. And by the way, this isn't even the wiretapping that is permitted through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, or those approved by the president outside the authority of the federal wiretap law. This is just everyone is wiretapping. Everyone's reading our emails. Everyone is wants to know, did you attend any demonstration? Were you against something? And now they're making lists. And last week they actually arrested an individual, a whole SWAT team, because he was at the Republican presidential nomination convention, and he led the protest there, and he had done nothing illegal, but they went in there and arrested him, and because of suspicion. And now anyone who does anything that is considered at all anti-government policy is now put on a terrorist watch list, and that's wrong. That's fascism.
I mean, I think the fascism is actually has progressed much farther than people realize, and that we really already are in an age of fascism. But it's a much more subtle kind of fascism than was practiced in Germany and Italy in the 30s. You know, now it's not that you necessarily get arrested and tortured for expressing opposing views. It's that the system is so designed that your words become impotent. You can say all you want on your radio show, you know, or on all of these leftist publications, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's just a bunch of words that, I mean, people have been shouting the truth from the rooftops about the environmental situation, about the geopolitical situation for 30, 40 years. I mean, I've been reading this stuff ever since I was a teenager about globalization, about the destruction of the rainforests, you know, and what do these words matter? So it's, I think that the fascism is on a much more subtle level than people realize. And I mean, certainly what you speak about, the wiretaps and the terrorism watch lists and all that stuff, that's one aspect of it. But I think it's even less important than the kind of generalized systemic mechanisms by which dissent is silenced or made irrelevant. Even a protest, you go out there, you know, and it becomes kind of a media footnote.
Well, I'm going to do a commentary tomorrow on the media and what role it's playing in dumbing down Americans and controlling the discussions and leaving the progressive minds out of the discussions. And that's what concerns me, that the Democrats have excluded third party and progressive minds. You don't hear any really good progressives up there, but you have good card carrying Democrats and liberals. And as on the right, you don't have progressives. We need progressives in there to offer legitimate challenges, and yet it's being denied. So third party input is denied because we have one party with two heads. We're out of time. Yeah. Charles Eisenstein, thank you very much. I really appreciate your good work. And the book is Sacred Economics, Money, Gift, and Society in the Age of Transition. All the best to you in educating the public about this important issue.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll, and that concludes the interview part of our program. A brief break. Right back. Please don't go anywhere. We still have 46 minutes to share with you.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.